DiscerningHearts.com presents The Way of Life, Reflections on the Teachings of St. John Paul II with Dr. Carson Holloway. Dr. Holloway is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and a former William E. Simon Visiting Fellow in Princeton University's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. He's the author of Magnanimity and Statesmanship, The Right Darwin, Evolution, Religion, and the Future of Democracy, All Shook Up, Music, Passion, and Politics, and The Way of Life, John Paul II and the Challenge of Liberal Modernity, the book on which this program is based. The Way of Life, Reflections on the Teachings of St. John Paul II with Dr. Carson Holloway. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Welcome back, Dr. Holloway.
Thanks for having me back, Chris.
Our late great Holy Father John Paul II attempted in Evangelium Vitae to try to correct the philosophical course that began sliding down that big slope back in the time of Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, and now would take us past the Scottish Enlightenment. For many people out there, they may not have even realized that there was a Scottish Enlightenment and its influence on us even today in America.
Yeah, the Scottish Enlightenment was a pretty important movement in thought that involves some major figures like David Hume, who we'll talk about and whose I deal with in the book, but also Adam Smith, the author of The Wealth of Nations, sort of taken as the preeminent theorist of capitalism or free market economics. But just as a footnote, Smith understood himself primarily as a moral philosopher, and he thought that his book on the theory of moral sentiments was more important, and his major work more important than The Wealth of Nations. It's an important alternative strand, I think, in liberal modernity, and one that has to be dealt with, and that's why I devote a chapter to it in the book.
One more time, just the definition of liberal modernity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by liberal modernity, I mean, in my book, this movement in philosophy and in politics that tends to organize political life around the self-interested individual and his or her rights, understood in contrast to what John Paul II and the Catholic tradition are interested in, which is, I think, the primacy of community and certainly there's an understanding of the dignity of the individual, but it's not based upon the individual's self-interest so much as it's based upon the idea that the individual is ultimately intended to be in union with God through works of moral nobility and righteousness and holiness.
Now, it's interesting that for those men that we have discussed and will continue to discuss, they come from the hearts of Christian nations, essentially. And, of course, for a Christian, it is the golden rule. Love God with all your heart, but also love your neighbor as you love yourself. So how this philosophical thought began to take root, 1700 years after the first proclamation of the gospel, of that essential truth, how that came about and would later influence nations that were essentially what they considered Christian nations. I mean, how do you reconcile those two attitudes?
Yeah. Well, and it may be that liberal modernity is parasitic, you know, that it wants to set up this idea that human beings have rights and that it's ultimately deriving that from some kind of culture influenced by the Bible and by divine revelation. And then they want to reject all the stuff that's demanding or that they find hard to understand and this kind of secularize this kind of thing. There's political scholar of political philosophy, Leo Strauss, who says, you know, that about, for example, Hobbes, you know, Hobbes says that the Leviathan or the state, the sovereign, will be lord of the proud. In other words, he'll overawe the proud and kind of make people submit to the conditions of peace. And Strauss says that this is an obvious secularization of the way in which God overawes the proud, although he does it not only with a view to peace, but to the holiness of people, right? And so, yeah, I think there is a way in which liberal modernity is indebted to Christianity, but doesn't want to admit it. And in a way, it's kind of cutting off the roots of its own best impulses. And I think, whether I think that or not is maybe not so interesting, but I do think that's what John Paul II thought, that the whole Enlightenment project of asserting the dignity of man and the dignity of the individual is good in some ways on a superficial level, but they've really tried to do this in either without reference to Christianity or really probably more realistically in open rebellion against Christianity. And it's a doomed project, I think, to him. And another point I would make on that is that since you noted that these kinds of erroneous theories emerged from Christian societies, how could that happen? And how could they get away with it? I mean, I think Hobbes and Locke are very careful in their published writings to be respectful of Christianity and to try to present their teachings as if they're in harmony with Christianity. That involves a lot of fancy footwork and probably a Catholic would say reinterpretation of the scriptures. A Catholic might even say doing violence to the scriptures to make mm-hmm. them fit their purposes. But they had to be careful to do that. I mean, even Hobbes, who, as we've talked about in past meetings, is kind of materialistic, relativistic, individualistic, even he frames his teaching in terms of, quote-unquote, the law of nature, you know, natural law. So, I mean, if you read him very superficially, you might think, okay, natural law sounds like a Thomas Aquinas, you know. Mm-hmm. Even he is respectful enough of the tradition that he tries to kind of rethink everything and redefine everything, but using terms that are familiar. And I think Locke is very similar. By the time you get to Hume, however, even though Hume in some ways is, I think, more accurate about human nature and more helpful than Hobbes, Hume is more openly dismissive of religion. I think he lives late enough, you know, in the 1700s, middle of the 1700s, that he can kind of, you know, it's safe now to be a scoffer. Mm-hmm. And you can get away with it as long as you're not too obnoxious about it.
Yes, we're talking about, of course, David Hume, who was a member, or essentially, would you say he was the leader of the Scottish Enlightenment?
At least a leading figure. Probably, if you had to pick one, it would be him.
Talk to us about his influence.
Yeah. I thought it was important to deal with him and the Scottish Enlightenment in the book because it represents, again, like Locke, a more moderate and maybe a more, I've used the word wholesome, or a more humane strand of liberal modernity. I mean, Thomas Hobbes, who we dealt with first, seems to me the most consistent thinker and the most clear thinker. But in some ways, that makes him the easiest target. I mean, it's easy to show that Hobbes's teaching is corrupt from the standpoint of John Paul II. Mm-hmm. It gets harder with Locke because Locke brings in the law of nature and God as the author of human life. And it's also hard with Hume because Hume doesn't buy into this idea that you get in Hobbes and Locke, that human beings are totally self-interested and that morality is therefore simply a human invention. I mean, if you wanted to sum up certainly Hobbes's teaching and probably Locke's, that would be it. Human beings are basically self-interested and they invent morality for the sake of protecting themselves in their self-interest. And this is the philosophic mistake that the Pope thinks is part of the culture of death. Well, Hume goes out of his way to set up his teaching in opposition to what he calls, quote-unquote, the selfish system of morals that he attributes to Thomas Hobbes and John Locke. And he says their big mistake is in thinking that morality is not rooted in human nature at all, because it is somewhat rooted in human nature, and this is why the title of the chapter is Hume and the Morality of Sympathy. Hume says, look, human beings are by nature sociable beings. They're not by nature isolated the way Hobbes and Locke thought. There is no state of nature where human beings are isolated from each other the way Hobbes and Locke thought. Hume says, morality is rooted in human nature, in the constitution of our being, to use his terms, because we have natural sympathy. Human beings can feel with each other. And that means that when I don't hurt somebody, it's not just that I'm thinking I better not hurt him because he might hurt me. It's that it would give me pain to hurt somebody else because of my natural sympathetic feelings for others. So for Hume, there is a basis in human nature for concern for others. It's not just a matter of calculation. Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, from the standpoint of John Paul II, he would say that is more accurate, more true, and more helpful than what Hobbes and Locke say. Now, one danger in Hume, though, is that he is, like Hobbes and Locke, for want of a better term, worldly. He's very clear in kind of saying there's no transcendent horizon for human beings. Morality doesn't really have anything to do with the perfection of human beings, but it does have a kind of basis in human nature as this sympathetic concern for others. So to that extent, he's making a mistake, I think the Pope would say. Again, you've got to understand human beings in light of their highest end, and Hume doesn't have anything to say about a highest end, but he does at least have something to say about human nature having a basis for morality in it.
Now, he wouldn't be mentioned along with the Scottish Enlightenment if there wasn't a flaw in his philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
What's the intrinsic flaw?
Yeah, I think the flaw is that it's kind of a parallel case to Locke, but with these kind of different variations resulting from his emphasis on human sociability and sympathy, is that once you strip away all the window dressing, if I can put it that aggressively, he's a Hobbesian at heart. First of all, in the sense that Hume, like Hobbes, thinks morality is derived from the passions. For Hobbes, that meant, you know, we have a passionate interest in our own preservation, and then we can invent some kind of morality that we'll all agree on that will protect us all. Hume means something a little bit more robust than that, in the idea that, as I've already said, well, you know, people have a passionate attachment not only to themselves but to other people. They have sympathetic feelings for others, and so justice, understood as doing what's good for another person, does have a direct resonance with my own feelings. But that's already kind of a dangerous step, I think, from the standpoint of the Pope, who would say, if morality is going to have an objective status and be obligatory on you at all times, it can't just be derived from the passions, because frankly, sometimes you won't feel like being moral, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this gets to be the problem, is that Hume, even though he talks about sympathy and, or what he calls humanity in other contexts, care for others, when it gets down to the hard cases or the basic facts, he admits that self-interest is more powerful than sympathy, you know? And you put those things together, if self-interest is more powerful of a passion than sympathy, ordinarily, and if morality is derived from our passions, that means morality in the end is going to get sucked back to what's good for me, not what's good for others. And although there's a certain happiness you might get from serving others in Hume, more than in, say, Hobbes, it's not going to be the ultimate happiness. And when it comes down to the conflict, I think, between you or somebody else, you're always going to prefer yourself. And in fact, Hume is open enough about his disdain for religion that he derides what he calls the monkish virtues of, you know, like self-sacrifice, celibacy, you know, fasting and things like this. I mean, anything that would discipline your passions just for the sake of disciplining them, or I guess really the way we would understand is disciplining them for the sake of love, he thinks is foolish, you know, because happiness is going to be realized in the realm of the passions. And I think that's the real weakness in his philosophy that leads to, you know, all the same problems that you get in Hobbes.
Yeah, that it goes back to essentially the golden rule.
Mm-hmm.
You love God and you love your neighbor as you love yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as though, okay, maybe we might give God his due, but we really love ourselves, but the neighbor part, mm-hmm. I can take that or leave it.
Yeah.
That becomes no longer a mandatory element of our thoughts and a basis for our laws, because then it becomes, as long as it doesn't interfere with my needs
mm-hmm.
and my self-interest.
Yeah. And I think Hume does understand that self-interest a little more broadly than the earlier thinkers like Hobbes, because he believes in this natural sociability. But it still ends up being kind of ugly, I think, because, put it this way, for Hobbes says very baldly, the worth of a man is what people would pay for the use of his power, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's pretty contrary to human dignity, I think, in a very obvious way from the standpoint of the Pope's teaching. And so the idea there is, because we're fundamentally concerned with our own self-preservation, if you don't contribute anything to that, then I regard you as worthless, right? Well, we're not quite such radical individuals for Hume, and he talks about our natural sociability and how we enjoy the company of other human beings, but it still does kind of come down to something that's rather impoverished, because for Hume, if somebody doesn't contribute anything materially, and if they don't contribute anything socially in the sense that, say, like they're ill or crazy, you know, for that matter, if they're not socially engaging, like what if they're not witty or fun to be around, they're kind of worthless from the standpoint of Hume's teaching, because their worth depends upon how they're able to engage your feelings, you know, and if they can't contribute anything to your kind of economic interest, and if they can't contribute anything to like your social entertainment, what use are they? And he's very clear about this when he talks about the fool, you know, or what we might call the mentally disabled person. He says, you know, there's just nothing there that you would love.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, he says, maybe a mother would love a fool, but it's death to anybody else's love because they are so worthless, you know. Or, you know, he says they're a burden upon the earth, a useless burden upon the earth, which actually kind of echoes the Pope's later remark about how the culture of death regards disabled people as an intolerable burden, because what do they contribute? You know, they're not entertaining for Hume, and they're not productive. So what good are they? They don't have an intrinsic value.
And that's where the danger is.
Mm-hmm.
Because now we've slid into eugenics.
Mm-hmm.
That essentially sets the table for who will decide, given our sympathies, no longer the law,
right.
Just the fact that each person has a right to life,
right.
Or a right to a certain dignity.
Yeah.
Now we're at the point where it's how we feel.
Mm-hmm.
So who determines whose feelings trump others' feelings?
Right. No, I think that's a very good way to put it, because for Hume, your obligations to other people really do come down to how they're able to engage your feelings. And we know from experience that there are classes of people who really don't have a hold on anybody else's feelings. Certainly if you think about this in relation to the things that John Paul II was concerned with, like the unborn, right? I mean, the unborn are not in much of a position to engage other people's feelings because they can't interact with them on a face-to-face basis. So they're not going to have much to recommend, you know, there's not going to have much hold upon human nature and upon respect from other people if you're among the unborn, or again, the seriously debilitated, or those who are dying of a terminal illness. I mean, they can't interact, you know, you get to look at them as just kind of a thing that's not really human anymore from Hume's standpoint. There are really dangerous consequences that follow from that. I mean, those things are bad enough, let's face it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But again, the Pope wants to remind us that this denial of the intrinsic dignity of the human person doesn't just stop at the abuses we already see, but leads in principle to tyranny. Well, I mean, you're going to easily find walking around people who can't really engage your sympathy. I mean, human being, as even Hume admits, sympathy doesn't really have that much scope. I mean, there's a lot of sympathy within the family, a lot within the community or the country when you're dealing with people that you understand, who look like you, who talk like you, and you can kind of feel with them. But then once you get beyond the bounds of your kind of immediate community, you're going to start dealing with people that don't look like you, don't talk like you, they don't think like you, or at least they don't appear to when you first engage with them. They just don't seem to be part of your people, you know, and it's going to be harder to sympathize with them. You know, you're putting them in a dangerous position if you argue that their ability to command your sympathy is the basis of their rights. This relates back to our earlier discussion of slavery, too, in a previous program. Hume is fairly consistent, and he throws up this kind of thought experiment in one of his writings where he says, if there were a race of people who were rational, like us, but who were so inferior in body and mind that they couldn't make their resentment felt upon us, we'd have to say there's no justice between us and them, right?
Mm.
He says there might be restraints of humanity or sympathy, but there'd be no justice, which is to say they can't have any rights, which is to say, in turn, that you get rights by being strong enough to threaten other people, right?
Right?
Which brings you back basically to Hobbes, you know, that we have justice among ourselves because we're afraid of each other and we're afraid of the mutual threats that we pose to each other. Whereas this supposedly fictional creation of Hume's mind, like a race of people who are basically like us in their humanity but so inferior in power that they can't threaten us, they would have no rights. Well, that corresponds to, say, the unborn or the disabled. Or even, if we're thinking politically, it could correspond to an alien race of people whose civilization is so less developed that we can conquer them and enslave them.
It manifests itself over and over again. We turn to the example of slavery in the United States several times now.
Mm-hmm.
But we can also look at what happened to the Native American culture prior to the influx of Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at what happened to not only in North America, but also in Central America and South America, what happened to the indigenous people of the Americas, because of that type of thought, they were mm-hmm. considered savages.
Yeah.
And we look back now and we think how inhumane, how unjust.
Yeah.
But at the time, because of this type of thought, it was completely accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And not just in that case, too, I also have to just jump to another example of to maybe make it even more relatable to some people who think, well, that was more of an obvious thing, but yet even towards the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, when you look at the influx of Irish immigrants from that came into this country,
mm-hmm.
leaving an area where they were considered second or third class humans,
mm-hmm.
and even in their influx into the United States, the treatment that they endured, it's not that far removed. I mean, you look at Rwanda
mm-hmm.
in the 1990s, what's happened in the Sudan, you can look all around the world. And
mm-hmm.
it's that type of thought still is very, very prevalent.
Yeah. I think that's a very good point also, because it seems to me that one way in which liberal modernity thinks it can get away with its rejection of theology and rejection of Christianity is they act as if, don't we all kind of know that we have rights and dignity and that we're all the same? In other words, I've even seen other thinkers like Francis Fukuyama, who I talk about in a different book, kind of says, well, religion was good at introducing the idea of human dignity, but now that idea is so well entrenched in world culture that we don't need religion anymore. It seems to me that's just false. I mean, you can look around the world. I mean, first of all, even if it were true that human dignity is well entrenched on secular grounds today, I mean, 100, 200, 300 years is not that long in the course of human civilization. We don't have to go that far back in the past to see that it was not that well entrenched. And what led to its becoming more entrenched was not sympathy, but the idea that everybody is created in the image and likeness of God, right? That there's an objective rule about how you treat human beings as human beings, whether or not they can affect your sympathy. And that would lead us to think imaginatively in the future and wonder whether, I mean, how could we say with confidence that, you know, respect for rights and dignity are so well entrenched they can never be undermined, even if we reject the theological underpinnings. But we don't even have to go into the future because, as you point out, there's things going on all over the world that are grave denials of human dignity that arise because people don't... I mean, they arise in part because of natural human weakness and evil, but they also arise because people have a wrong understanding of the dignity of the human person. And it's evidence, I think, that the Pope still would say we have to get it right. You know, we have to understand what human beings are to help us treat them the way they deserve to be treated.
So we've talked about Thomas Hobbes and John Locke and David Hume and his involvement in the influence of the Scottish Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. All of those philosophies would find their way intermeshed into what would be the philosophical foundations for our government. Mm-hmm. Also, another government that was forming at the towards the end of the 1700s, and I'm thinking of the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. And the big difference in that, in the French Revolution, they essentially totally dismissed anything religion, mm-hmm. everything religion, all foundations. They were, I guess you could say that they were David Hume to the extreme, as far as their passions and their feelings and what would happen, mm-hmm. as opposed to what was happening in America.
Yeah, I mean... Especially with regard to, I mean, I know the American case better. As a kind of footnote, and I don't know enough to speak about this at great length, but I mean, Hume is, to some people, considered to be a conservative because in politics, he's very cautious. You know, he kind of figures, well, you know, human beings are, as we've described them, passionate, but also sociable. And so, you know, he's not sympathetic to revolutionary movements on the surface like the French Revolution, although I think you're right to point to other deeper connections. I mean, Hume is trying to cut himself off from the thought of the past, you know, mm-hmm. and reinvent what it means to be human, or to re-understand what it means to be human. And the French revolutionaries are doing the same thing. I mean, the thought of the past has no authority for them. But clearly, the Scottish Enlightenment, as well as Hobbes and Locke, influenced the American founders. And that should give us some pause. I mean, America's a great country, and its founding principles are very good and just to a certain extent. And there's a lot there to admire. But yeah, the Pope would certainly have us think hard, I think, about whether there might be problems when you see the philosophic origins that influenced the founders. It's, you know, I don't want to be too hard on the founders because they were also influenced by Christianity. Mm-hmm. And that's evident in a lot of what they had to say. And in some ways, I even kind of admit in the book that like the way the rights teaching is presented in the Declaration of Independence is better than the way it's presented in Locke. Because there's a little bit more cleaner theology to it. But still, I as much as we admire our own country, we can't be immune from self-criticism. And I think the Pope is inviting us to that, even though, again, I have to admit that when the Pope would come to America and he wanted to emphasize the right for life, he would invoke the Declaration of Independence. I mean, it's there, and its principles are good as far as they go.
Well, I think you pointed out something very, very important, the fact that the particular philosophies that we've discussed, whether it's Hobbes or Locke or even Hume, that in tandem, enmeshed with Christian theological viewpoints, mm-hmm. stand as part of the legs on that particular table. Today, there are many who would want to cut off the Christian leg.
Yeah.
So what happens to the table?
That's right. It falls over.
Yeah. You know?
And that's a good way to look at it because I think, as I kind of hinted in a remark earlier, just because Hume and Hobbes and Locke have problems doesn't mean that what they see in human nature is totally false. There might be things about government that are sensible that you could learn from Hobbes and Locke and Hume, and there might be certain arguments in their teaching that illuminate the truth. And it might be that a country that adopts what it can from them and combines it with a Christian heritage would be a well-organized country. And that might be one of our problems more recently, is that we, like you say, many people in America want to take out the Christian strand or the religious strand in the American tradition. And I mean, because they wrongly think, and this gets later, I think, or gets into the Tocqueville chapter in my book later too, they wrongly think that religion's a source of oppression, you know, rather than being a support for belief in human dignity and rights.
Should make us pause at the very least when an American president would go to foreign lands and say very boldly that we are not a Christian nation.
Mm-hmm.
That should make us stop and pause.
Yeah, because it's not so clear that you can, first of all, it's not so clear that you can disentangle the Christian contribution to the founding from whatever it is that we find good about America. I mean, it's true that America is not a theocratic nation, or it's not mm-hmm. committed in the Constitution to any particular religious tradition. But, you know, you got to be more careful about the way you put these things, right? Because as a sociological matter, America is a Christian nation still. I mean, it's predominantly Christian. So, yeah, it's not uncommon for politicians to be careless in the way they put these things, either by design or accident. I'm not sure.
Professor Holloway, I'm looking forward to our next segment when we talk about the founders and how they may have been influenced by these particular philosophies.
Very good. I look forward to it, too.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to The Way of Life, Reflections on the Teachings of St. John Paul II with Dr. Carson Holloway. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join us next time for The Way of Life, Reflections on the Teachings of St. John Paul II with Dr. Carson Holloway.